and announce that the title, The Celebration of Aging, A Greater Freedom, Don't Fence Me In, is what we're working on today. Someone mentioned the other day that we as teachers of religion and students of theology use a very peculiar type of vocabulary and language, and someone asked, you know, why don't you use some horse sense and use some, you know, some common language that we can all understand? Well, there are horses, you know, that understand religious language. You heard the story of the farmer who bought a new team of horses, and the fellow said, well, these are very, very religious horses. You know, instead of saying, get up, you have to say, thank God, to get them started. And when you want to stop, instead of saying, whoa, whoa, you say, Holy Trinity. And so the horses were delivered, and the farmer tried them out the first day, and he forgot this. He said, get up, but finally he remembered, said, thank God, and off they went across the field. And there was a ravine going through the pasture, and all before he knew it, he was right at the edge of the ravine, and he was calling, whoa, 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 and they didn't stop. And just the last minute, he remembered the religious language, and he said, Holy Trinity, and they stopped right at the edge of the cliff. And he was so relieved, he said, oh, thank God. Well, even though we use this theological language, I hope there will be some points where what we're talking about touch you at your own lived experiences as you go through the stops and starts and of life. The theme that we're working on this week is summarized in the statement, the Christ for all seasons calls us to celebrate aging by becoming centers of a greater freedom, a deeper wisdom, and a wider love. In our earlier sessions, we have talked about the process of becoming. Yesterday, we talked about centering. And our theme today is this leads to a greater freedom. Don't fence me in, therefore. Now, those of you who are experiencing aging, as we all are, might ask the question, how can you claim that there is a greater freedom with aging when any realistic analysis shows it to be the experience of new and greater limits, physical limits that come with aging, mental, social? We're going to return to this experience of limits. But if you understand freedom in the popular sense as doing whatever you please, having no limits at all, then, of course, you're right. But there is another understanding, a deeper understanding of freedom in the Christian sense, and we want to try to approach this from the biblical perspective, and so the base from which we proceed is the Gospel of John, the 8th chapter, verses 31 and following. If you remember there, Jesus said to the Jews who had believed in him, if you continue in my word, you are truly my disciples, and you will know the truth, and the truth will make you free. They answered him, we are descendants of Abraham and have never been in bondage to anyone. How is it that you say you will be made free? And Jesus answered them, truly, truly, I say to you, everyone who commits sin is a slave to sin. The slave does not continue in the house forever. The Son continues forever. So if the Son makes you free, you will be free indeed. Well, we're going to try to spell that freedom out. Freedom from a biblical perspective. We start out by sort of repeating some of the things that we've said in earlier sessions, but I think from a little different perspective, by trying to understand how the Bible interprets human nature. And I'm using an analysis that was made originally by Reinhold Niebuhr, one of our American theologians. I've tried to diagram it on the board here, and if I get out of the way, then you can read some of it. He says, human nature, our human existence, is characterized by two basic elements. We have the capacity for self-transcendence, and at the same time, we are limited creatures. Now, let me talk a little bit about what is meant by self-transcendence or spirit dimension of life. It's the capacity to, you know, stand outside of ourselves and make our own lives the subject of our examination. we all have that capacity. My students come to the end of the semester, and then they look back, and when the final exam comes and they're not ready, they ask, you know, what in the world was I doing all semester long? Or, you know, the fellow that was driving on these icy roads in Minnesota at 60, 70, 80 miles an hour and ended up in the ditch and was injured, and the first car came along, and he called out to the fellow that stopped to help him, are you a doctor? Are you a doctor? And the fellow coming down said, well, no, but I'm a veterinarian. And the fellow said, oh, that's all right. Only a jackass would have been driving like I was down that road. And you hold your life up to examination. Sometimes this capacity for self-transcendence gets so centered upon the self that it becomes perverted, like the fellow that could never, you know, stand to go to a football game because every time they had a huddle, he thought they were talking about him. that we all know. There's no theologian that needs to tell you that we have this capacity to stand in review of our own life. But let me put it in a little different light, that capacity of spiritual dimension that makes us different from the rest of the animal kingdom is the way that we experience death. Death comes to all creatures, and it's shared by all, but it's different for human beings because we are the only ones who can look forward and perceive our death. And therefore, it has an entirely different dimension. We can, in the face of death, in the face of the gift of life, decide whether we want to live or not live, to ask Hamlet's question, to be or not to be, and if it's not worth being, we can, well, suicide is a human potential. We stand over our own death even in that way. Tremendous capacity to hold our life in under review. Memory is another character evidence of this capacity of self-transcendence. We can bring the ages of the past into the present through memory and stand on the shoulders of the giants of the past and look to the future. And that capacity, Augustine in his Confessions has a wonderful passage of the great gift of memory, of what it is to walk through the halls of the past and bring it into the present, and to be able, on the basis of the experience of the past of other generations, to make decisions in the present that will affect your future. We could give other evidence of this, but what are the implications of this capacity of self-transcendence or of the spiritual dimension of human existence? Well, I think the first is that we do have some degree of freedom. It gives us the capacity to look to the future and to be responsible for how we shape that future. I suppose there are those philosophically and others who would say we are determined by our environment or our heredity and everything is mapped out for us. But if we, and I know we can learn much from the psychologists and the sociologists and the others who tell us how our behaviors are affected by outside forces. But in a homely sort of way, I like to think that our own experience of being responsible and being free should stand over against that. And the evidence for our freedom in some sort of a backhanded way is that is our own experience of guilt. Now, not that guilt is a good thing, but there is a healthy guilt. And because guilt tells us and lets us know in a personal way when we experience guilt that we have violated the law of love. And not to experience guilt when you violate the law of love is to be less than human. And so when in our courts, when somebody is not able to, you know, can go through and commit murders and anything and never feel any guilt, they know that that is a neurotic, psychotic person because they no longer are able to experience guilt. Guilt is in some way a testimony to the fact that we hold ourselves to be responsible, and freedom means that we respond to situations and that we have some play in them. And our self-transcendence makes that freedom possible to us. Some people don't like talk about guilt. College students usually don't like to talk about guilt. But there is healthy guilt, and it's not to get tied up in guilt. But there was a psychiatrist that was working up at Wilmer, and he came out of an interview session with one of the patients, this Wilmer, Minnesota, the mental hospital, and ran into the chaplain in the hall and said to the chaplain, "Oh, if it were not for all you preachers, you know, preaching the law and don't do this and don't do that, we wouldn't have all these people here with all these hang-ups." And the chaplain reflected for a moment and said, "Well, how would you like your teenage daughter to grow up in a world where there were no restraints and there were no sense of responsibility of right and wrong? And not to be able to feel guilt when you break the law of love is something, is to be less than human." And so there's healthy guilt. We all know there is neurotic religious guilt, too. We're not talking about that, to be guilty of things that you shouldn't be guilty about. But guilt is a testimony that we at least have some dimension of freedom and are responsible persons. Well, I want to just skip over the others. Individuality, this self-transcendence means that we have the capacity to shape ourselves as unique individuals. That there's not another you. We're not turned out on a mimeograph machine, on a ditto machine. We shape our unique eyes and egos in ways that nobody can duplicate because we are free and responsible beings. But it also means, because of this self-transcendence, that in order to be human, we have to have some meaning in life. I think it says that there is a religious dimension to life that is there inevitably, that to live with purpose and to live with meaning is essential for us. We have to shape a mission in life. Well, those are some of the implications of self-transcendence. And we don't need to spend so much time on this other, do we, that we are limited creatures. What is the evidence of that? We are born, we die, we are embodied beings. If you think you're some disembodied angel, then just remember that you have to go to the John every once in a while. And we know the limitations of being physically embodied people. But included, the implications of this are that we do not have absolute freedom. Freedom always operates within limits. We didn't choose, you know, when we would be born, who our parents were, what our IQ would be, what race we would be of. All kinds of limits, are there not, on our freedom, because we are bound being. But the biblical perspective on this, if we stop just a moment, is that these are not opposed to each other. There is the unity of this in the holistic understanding of the self. And even death itself is proclaimed from the biblical perspective. It's a limit for us, but it is part of the creation of which God says all is good. Stop for a minute. Usual interpretation of Genesis is that death came into the world as a result of sin. And I think it's part of God's good creation. And what came into the world because of sin is the fear of death. That we were not willing to trust God even in our death. And what would, you know, finite existence always in, that's part of God's good creation. And we as human beings share it with the rest of the created order of beings. And so of this structure of his existence, all of limitations and possibilities, we say all is good. But here comes the situation that Niebuhr now analyzes, and Kierkegaard, the Danish philosopher, was the one on whom Niebuhr built his analysis, that there is a tension here between our self-transcendence and our creaturehood that leads to a basic anxiety in life. By that, he means that we recognize we have freedoms, but yet there are limits to those freedoms, but we do not know exactly what those limits are and what those possibilities are. So that every time we set out in a new adventure, make a new decision, we cannot be assured that we are going to have the resources to accomplish it. Maybe we overstep our limits and end in failure. There may be a creative outcome. What is your experience in making important decisions? Don't you always experience a certain amount of anxiety? Is this going to work? Should I do this? Should I not? And Niebuhr says this anxiety is not sinful. It's just the way things are because we are creative, self-transcendent beings. And of course, the tension of that of human existence with being responsible is just too much for some people. Dostoevsky, in one of his novels, has one of the characters say, "Oh, decisions, decisions, decisions. If I could only be a worm, you know, and crawl into a hole, you know, and not have to make decisions," you'd get rid of some of that anxiety. And some do back out from human existence because of that. Well, this anxiety is a basic condition of life. It may be the situation that makes possible the experience of temptation, but it's not sinful in itself. You know, Martin Luther says you can let the birds fly over your head. You can't stop that, but you can stop them from making nests in your hair. Well, they wouldn't make very good nests in my hair. And the same with temptation. You cannot avoid having temptations. But you can avoid nurturing them, letting them make a nest. So anxiety is a situation of temptation. And I think that's what the Genesis 2 and 3 account of creation is describing with Eve. What is the human situation? We live in a world in which our freedom places in responsible decision-making process and the experience of anxiety and the experience of temptation. But it is not a sin to be tempted. It's a sin to fall to temptation. So that's part of the anxiety. And then the two possibilities of responding to this. In order to overcome this anxiety, there are many who respond to it in pride, saying, I am able to be in charge of my life and take responsibility for it, and I will proceed to do it on my own. That is the sin of pride, or theologically stated, the sin of unbelief. So this person, believing that they are self-reliant, self-made, self-dependent, proceeds on the adventure of overcoming and responding to this basic anxiety in life. But what they find is that they, deep down, are lying to themselves, and the result is the sinful anxiety. That's a different kind of anxiety. That's the anxiety of trying to live without dependence on God. And in order to tell the lie that you are a self-made person, out of that comes the specific sins of pride, those efforts by which you try to declare your independence. And those sins of pride are expressed through power. You have to gain power over other people to show that you are in command, and therefore you are never free to enter into a relationship of love with another person, because you always have to use that other person to support your sagging ego, your trembling ego. You're not free to love. You manipulate people, and that's what I think Dale Carnegie is about, how to win friends and manipulate them. You get into that business, you know. And the same with the pride of reason. You have to make the claim that you know more than you really know. You refuse to recognize the limits that are given to the reason. And I see illustrations of this with both the radical left and the radical right, religiously, politically. You know, they both have all the right answers, and they are absolutely down to the last iota. They will not listen to anything else. And you wonder, you know, religiously, if some of these people who have all the answers and can hit you over the head with them, if I could only be so certain that I had all these political problems from, and I'm talking about the extreme right and the extreme left politically and religiously. Wouldn't it be wonderful if I could, you know, be that certain that I had all the truth and there were no questions left over? But in reality, I'm convinced that they are the most anxious people in the world. And the reason that they have to hit you over the head with their truth is that they really know that they are not in absolute command of the truth, and they are in effect lying to themselves. They are the most uncertain people, and they cannot stand the tension of listening to another point of view, because they have to support their sagging ego that they're trying to make it on their own. And so also comes the sins of virtue. By that we mean the sins of Phariseeism, that the Pharisee who says, you know, I fulfill the law of God. Thank God I'm not like that publican over there. And you become more proud of your virtue than you have a right, because you're proving yourself by your own works. And the worst form of that is when it takes on a religious dimension, when religion becomes the instrument of pride, that you know all the truth and that all you do is what God wants you to do with no questions asked. To sin in the name of God is what Luther calls the greatest sin. To take your sin of pride and do it in the name of God, there's no greater sin than that. And so all of these manifestations of specific sins by which you violate other people and so forth come out of, however, sin in the singular, the sin of unbelief. And the Bible says if you're ever going to change this, you don't pass a law, don't do this, but it is have faith. Be not anxious. Trust God. This is life under the law. That's the way it works. It ends up there. And so the answer to that is to have faith and to recognize your dependence and trust in faith and belief in God. And out of that, knowing that you are not self-sufficient unto yourself, but dependent upon God, this anxiety, you know, of wanting to know more, of being curious, of wanting to experience new things, greater truth, greater love, all of these things that we want to experience, this anxiety that drives us to that, that can, when exercised in freedom, lead in faith and trust in God, lead to a creative freedom that sets you free to bear the fruits of the Spirit, which Ephesians puts in terms of love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. And that's the kind of freedom that we're talking about here, not freedom within limits. Now, there are two sort of limitations, it seems to me, in this diagram. And one is, of course, that all of this is too simple. There's nobody that lives in perfect faith, or anyone that lives totally in perfect self-confidence and pride. Life is ambiguous, and there's a little bit of both in all of our lives. So the only one that I know of who lived with perfect faith and trust in God the Creator was Jesus, and that's why we call him the Son of God. And he lived in such perfect confidence in God the Father that he lived his life without ever violating the law of love. And therefore we call him the second Adam. That which was the possibility of all creatures in the first Adam and was messed up, and which we all mess up, was fulfilled most perfectly by the second Adam, Christ, the Son of God. So that's the limitation of this diagram that we... But this is the human potential. The new creation is possible in an ambiguous way that we can share in that. The second thing I would... there have been critics of Niebuhr's analysis, and those who say that the main sin of pride, of overstepping one's limits, refusing to recognize your limits, is sort of a male, greater danger for men than for women. And possibly the greatest danger for women in our culture, the way that we have been situated, at least in our practice, is that they refuse to adventure out and to find out where those limits are. Not so much overstepping their limits, but not using their freedom to reach out. And they've let others set limits for them. Society set limits for them. And they have accepted too readily the stereotypes that our culture places upon them. I see several of our St. Olaf former students here, and I can tell these stories out of Northfield, I guess. But I notice the difference between some of the freshman women that I have in my classes coming with such brilliance and possibilities, and some of them get caught in the social structure of the college, and by the time of the seniors, they have, in order to conform to what the men around them expect, surrendered their intellectual brilliance and curiosity. It's a tragedy. It's changing, but it still happens. And that's what we mean by refusal, that there's probably as great a sin as over against the refusal to explore your limits as it is to be tempted to go beyond them. I don't know if that makes any sense out of your experience or not. But now I would like to sort of move to the application of this to the aging process. This is a fairly theoretical structure of what we're talking to help us get at what we mean by Christian freedom. And here I want to make use of a chart that there's a Robert Benny, who used to teach at Lutheran School of Theology, is a former schoolmate, classmate of mine, gives in one of his books about what is the personal situation and has tried to describe in this way the pressure points of life. You can apply this to both social and personal existence. In social existence, it's a matter of, you know, being able to achieve the possible within the limits of the given situation. But I'm going to be speaking primarily of our experience of it as individuals and is as persons in the experience of aging. Here is the recognition that the arrows coming down upon our personal existence of limits. Now, if we think freedom means absence of limits, emancipation from all restraints, then there is no freedom, because we all have limits, and it isn't something that all of a sudden starts with aging in the older stages of life. As children, parents were putting limits on us, schools were putting limits on us. We have limits all over the place, no matter what stage we're at. Sidney Harris, who is the sports columnist in the Minneapolis paper, once wrote a column. He's invited all over to give commencement addresses. And once he was invited to give a commencement address at the prison for their graduates at the prison school. And he refused because, as he said in his column, he said, "I don't think I would have anything to say to them." Now, I couldn't understand that, because is that, you know, all of us have our own bars in different or greater degrees. And to be under bars, to be within limits, is a human experience for all of us. And what you do is exercise your freedom within those limits. And here we're prison people who had exercised freedom to get an education within the limits of being behind those bars. And he didn't have anything to say to them. We all experience limits. We talked yesterday about the professional football player who comes to a very early stage of recognizing some of the limits of being able to carry out that vocation. They have to get out very early in life. What are some of the limits? We're going to come back to these. But in aging, there are the physical limits of the weakening of tonic interplay and connecting tissues in our blood distribution, our vessels. They change the mental limitations of memory and so forth, social limitations of a less responsible role in society, financial limitations, all these things on our freedom. You can't do anything you want to please, that you please. Uncontrollable events that happen, an accident, tragedy of some kind, a death of a loved one, an illness, limits of our abilities. You know, why was I born with such, you know, limited abilities? And the limit of time itself, you know. You can't do everything. You have to make choices. So, you know, I have 1,000 things I want to do, but I don't know if I'm going to have enough time to do them. So I have to make some important choices. Well, we all have limits. I have to tell you about our experience when we lived up in the retirement center at Ebenezer Society in Minneapolis. We had dinner one evening with one of our retired pastors who was living there. And he asked Margie and me whether we'd heard his butt sermon. And we said, no, we hadn't heard his butt sermon. Well, he said it's based on 1 Kings 5:1, where it says that Nahum was a man mighty in valor, but he had leprosy. And so he says, you know, there are 3 points I want to make. He said, so you learn from this. He says, first, everyone has a butt. You have your limits. Second, it's not easy to see your own butt. And third, he says, others can see your butt easier than you can. Well, he claims that he got this out of a commentary, but I think that he came out of his own creative imagination. And the next day, I was sitting with him out on the park, on the bench in front of the center, enjoying the sun, and he says, "Oh, I found another but." And that's Romans 3:23, where it says something to the effect, "But now the righteousness of God has been manifested apart from the law, that we are justified by his grace through redemption." So the "but" of God's grace can be put over against all the "buts" of our limitations. And that's the truth that is unique to Christian freedom. We want to come back to these limits and speak of them more specifically. But if I can move rather rapidly now through the rest of this. The other pressure points in life are the claims that are made upon us by others. By our children. Mrs. Morris was talking about the stage of her life last night when she was responsible for the care of her children. And that was limited your freedom, didn't it? Many, many ways. I visited with some individuals here who have talked about their care of their parents, elderly parents. We're having four-generation families where you can be retired 65, 67, 70 and have a 90, 95-year-old parent to care for. The responsibilities to the claims of your spouse, friends who need help, all these press in upon you. And what Benny says, and I think it's true, that many of these things, you know, you can interpret it as being negative. But in a way, they are the pressure points of God. Because God drives us through these limits to sort of confront the eternal. Especially in time, our experience of time, we have to confront the limit of death itself. And God calls us through these claims that are made upon us, the pressure points of the claims of other people, to be able and willing to grow in love as they make claims upon our lives. These are the pressure points of God. Well, the other parts of the diagrams show that there is also out there, coming in upon our lives, touching us in many different ways, support. You know, support through a spouse, through supportive children, through parents who've nurtured us, through friends, through colleagues, a caring community of the church. What it means to have a support group within which to exercise our freedom. That also is part of the pressure point. But also pressing in upon us are the possibilities of life. The anxiety that is basically there to want to know the truth, to experience a greater love, to do new things, to be free, to express oneself, to forge one's identity and relationship to others. Now, it is true that these two can be perverted and twisted. So that they become, you know, self-centered, you know, driven by desire to realize the possibility only of the self. They can be perverted, to be sure. But it is possible for this sort of outreach of freedom, of possibilities that still stand before us, for when life is lived out under the grace of God, that they present us with a creative freedom. And that's what we want to talk about. But before we take this down, all four of these make up the web of life. And we weave a pattern of meaning within all of these pressures. And it's possible to see the grace of God as all of these pressure points touch our lives. But when these pressure points are touched by the grace of God, And we've used the symbol here of the Greek cross. This also is Benny's outline. As a symbol of the Christ for all seasons. And over the pressure points of life is the grace of God. And when that happens and the individual experiences it, the way you experience it is very, very different with every individual, I'm sure. But it usually has four aspects of it that in various ways come to bear upon these pressure points. The first thing it says is that all is good. You know, to realize that in spite of all that has happened, that this is still God's world and that we are still in God's hands, makes it possible to affirm that this is a gracious world in which we live, that's under the care of God. This is not any sentimental type of, you know, I'm okay, you're okay type of thing, and everything is rosy and there are no bumps in life. But it is one that is based on a basic trust, you know, the basic faith that this is God's world and God is still in control. One put it this way, I will take the whole loaf of life as it comes, hulls and pits as well as the nutritious parts, and bite into it with all my being. You know, the Holden theme this year is the feast of life, gift of God. That's what we're trying to say here. Under grace, we can say life is a feast. It is good, basically good, because it's in the hands of God. This, you know, I was visiting with one of the people before the session yesterday, and she had done some of this life review that we tried out the first time and was thinking back of all those decisions. And one of the things that she said was, looking back over all those decisions that have made and what the outcomes were, you could still say, it was good. I wouldn't do it over again in any other way. That's a tremendous affirmation, isn't it? To say the goodness of life is experienced. The second aspect of the gift of grace is the recognition that you are accepted. Self-affirmation based not on some sentimental, I'm okay, you're okay, but based on the costly grace of God, that you can accept yourself because God accepts you. You shouldn't try to argue with God. With all your limits and possibilities, you are the one who can meet some need in this given time, in this situation. You can accept yourself as a worthwhile person with your own unique mystery and depth and greatness that is yours. That's the second aspect. And these two deal with our experience of time. The past is accepted, can be lived with, because it's forgiven. The grace of God covers those things in the past that haunt life. And we talked about that yesterday, our experience of guilt, our experience of past resentments that cloud the past, that those are under the grace of God, and they are forgiven. Someone said we ought to, that the way older people experience the devil is not so much as a tempter, as an accuser. When those accusations of I should have done this and why didn't I do that come, to let those be under the grace of the forgiveness of God and forgotten. Well, not really that you forget them. I don't think we do forget them. You should have a good forgettery about some things. Paul says you should forget the things that are behind and press on to the through the high calling of God in Christ Jesus. But you can't forget everything. Even though you remember them and do not lose them, to know that they are under grace and they are under forgiveness. And it does not mean either that simply because they are forgiven that you can go back and undo all of them. No. The sins of the past do shape what are your limits and what are your situation in the present. But the fact that they are forgiven makes it possible for you to shake off the chains of the past, the weight of the past, and launch out on a new future. The future becomes open again. And that's the greatest gift of forgiveness. Not only that, not that the past is forgiven, that's important, but that forgiveness opens up a new future. You can start with a clean slate. And I like to think of God working in our lives. Sure, certainly he works by pushing us through all those pressure points that we pointed to in the first diagram. But more important, God is the lure of the future. God stands before us in every situation, wherever we are, whatever mess we've made of it or whatever good things have happened, and holds out before us some ideal possibility that can be realized within the limits of that situation. God is the lure of the future into a greater freedom, into a greater love, to a greater wisdom. That's what grace does. So in the moment of grace, the future is open, whereas the pressures of life, those pressure points could overwhelm and defeat you, fence you in. Now under grace, we know that the future is not determined. With the help of God, we are free to shape that future. We can react as responsible people. Well, now I want to watch the... Oh my, I've taken so much time. Give you just a few examples of the exercise of freedom by some people that I have known. Well, maybe do it theoretically. What are some of the freedoms that you enjoy as older people or as retired? Freedom from the work ethic, from having your nose to the grindstone all the time. Someone said, free to take time to smell the roses, to enjoy nature, to be here at Holden. Free to laugh at misery, even. One of my friends is a chaplain in a Presbyterian home down in Evanston, and he came into the room of Maggie, who was dying of cancer, and she was always such a joker. And that day she said to him, "Chaplain, say to you, I want to tell you about the three men in my life." And so he said, "Well, I'll sure listen." And she said, "Well, you know, I spend all day with Art Ritus." And I go to bed with Charlie Horse. And I wake up with Will Power. I remember Helen Hayes saying, you know, when they were asking her how she kept going all the time, well, she says, sometimes you really do have to kick yourself out of bed and get going again. But another day he came in to her, and she had had a relapse and then a recovery again, and she was surprised to find her sitting up in bed knitting. And her explanation was, "Well," she said, "I'm not going to die in that damn bed." And that afternoon, she died with her unfinished knitting in her hand. Well, that's a freedom to even laugh at our miseries. I'm thinking of a Salyutian professor at Mrs. Salyutian at the University of Minnesota, a dynamic elderly person who is going blind. And she said the only way that she could continue to exercise her freedom was to recognize her dependence upon others. So she now calls on everybody to give her rides. And because she recognizes that she's not independent, that she's interdependent, to accept dependence allows her to be free, to continue to do many of the things that she wants to do. Well, I guess I should stop here, but simply add two applications. Many of you are dealing with elderly parents and with others who I'm talking about what I call normative aging. I guess there is pathological aging. When illness, Alzheimer's disease, and all that comes in, that's not what we've been talking about. But some of us have to deal with that. And the point of this, I think, the application of this greater freedom is that we should not rob any elderly person of their own autonomy, of their freedom. You have to, you do some of that, but respect their dignity by respecting their decision-making power. And the second application of it, I guess, is simply this for us as individuals, that we don't surrender our own freedom. In Galatians 5:1, Paul says, "For freedom Christ has set us free. Stand fast, therefore, and do not submit to a yoke of slavery." Don't let them fence you in. That's the point. And if John in the 8th chapter says, "So if the Son makes you free, you will be free indeed." That we grasp that greater freedom at this stage in life. Well, I have taken more time than I intended to, but there is about 10 minutes that we can discuss and have questions asked. So please feel free to fire away. Could I wanted to go back to the issue of limits and talk about them a little bit more realistically. And I've asked Dr. Bolstad, who has worked as a psychiatrist with the Veterans Administration in their program, The Elderly, to tell us a little bit. Maybe you could give us something, Ralph, that would help us to understand how you perceive those things. I'd appreciate it.
I think that what Omer has said about each of us being an individual is very important when we talk about aging. And not only each individual, but each part of each system of each individual is very important. So you could talk about the skin, you could talk about the joints, and the tendons, the subcutaneous tissue that makes us all look older than we, well, than we are, naturally. But the two things I'd like to talk about would be muscle for the one and nerve tissue for the other. Muscle is so important to us because it means that we can be mobile. And without mobility, we don't feel really human, most of us. We would have to work very hard. I would have to work very hard at feeling human if I weren't mobile. So it can be done. Well, many people have, and it's wonderful, but it'd be a lot of work. So we want to understand a little bit about our muscles. We were born with a certain number of muscle cells. Probably within the first year after we were born, the muscle cells started to drop out. We have less muscle. I have less muscle cells now than I did 10 years ago. There's no way that I can get more muscle cells back. What I can do is to increase the strength of those muscles, the muscle cell itself, but I can't get more of them. So there is a limit in how much I can do. I shouldn't take up professional boxing at my age. I think the rest of you would agree to that. What I can do, though, is to make use of what I have. And I think this is one of the things that Omar has been bringing out. Make use of what you have. He brought out, I think, the encouragement for you women to express and use the abilities which you have, which are probably a lot more than you thought you had. I don't know who convinced you. I'm not at all sure that the males are the only ones guilty at same trying to down the females. I think we all down each other. But anyway, it's interesting that at the age of 60, and again here, it's an individual thing, but that most wives become stronger than their husbands. It isn't a magic thing that happens on their 60th birthday, don't misunderstand. But men gradually become weaker. Women also, but they become weaker less rapidly than men do, so that the women tend to be stronger than men at 60. Now, I want you all to open the door for me when I leave. The other thing that happens, I don't have the total amount of muscle, but I can increase it. Okay, that's one thing. Nerve tissue is slower than it was when I was 20. One of the most embarrassing things that happened to me, as I remember back in my early middle age, was getting out and playing softball with the boys and fanning out three times in a row. Your eye muscle coordination is not as good as it was, but it's still very good, and there's a great deal that you can do to increase it. Take Picasso at in his 90s, he drew made any number of pictures, art objects. He changed from one expression. He was doing ceramics. He was doing all kinds of things at the age of 90, making a lot of money out of it. So we can think of the people who can do that. He wasn't, in some ways, as good at 90, I'm sure, as he was at 60. But he had a lot more experience. But you do have some decrease in the speed of your reaction. Don't get into a fight with somebody that much younger than you are, because he can hit you faster, or she can hit you faster. And those are the dangerous people. Remember that, men. The women are probably stronger than you are at this point. The other thing about these two, well, about muscle, is that it takes longer to increase your strength than it did when you were younger. So don't feel that all is lost when, after practicing, doing some walking for 2 weeks, and you really don't notice much difference. It's there, but it takes you longer to increase the strength of your muscle now than it did 40 years ago. Just remember that and say, okay, so I got a lot more smarts now than I did then. I have more patience. I have more curiosity. I can go ahead and continue to work on increasing my muscle strength. It can be done. We often, we don't hear so much about it, but we think about it, each of us. Oh, I'm getting so old now, I'm going to be stupid and I can't learn anything. Well, that's not true. They have done intelligence tests serially on one person, for instance, and they have found that a person at 80 does as well on his intelligence test, or maybe a little better, than he did when he was 60 or 40 or 20. Now, memorizing nonsense syllables might be more difficult for us now, but the experience comes in to allow us to solve problems, do the things that we think of as intelligence, just as well now as we did before. So, I keep thinking of the story that I'm sure all of you have heard, but I want to bring it back to your memory. This young man had been in a skiing accident, broken his hand badly, and his mother was worried about him. She went with him to the orthopedist. He set his hand, did all this work, and afterwards she talked to him seriously and said, "Now, will John be able to play the piano when he gets through with all this?" And he says, "Oh, he should be able to play very well when he gets, shouldn't bother him at all." And she says, "Oh, I'm so thankful, because he never could get the hang of it before." We got to remember that hey, you're not going to play the piano without a lot of work on it. But we can do it. Muscle and nerve cells, we're probably in a better position in many ways to do things now than we were as a youngster. Thank you.
Yes, Pierre.
You mentioned that woman who had gone blind, and that her freedom came through her recognition that she was dependent upon others.
Yeah.
And earlier you were talking about the dependence upon God with regards to how we don't do that, how we don't allow for that when we enact our sinful anxiety.
Yeah.
And it would seem that the more one looks for one's dependencies upon others, the more one becomes able to recognize and therefore be free.
Yeah.
And that we don't, especially in this society, want to look for that. We want that independence. We want that sense of otherness from others, sense of difference from others.
Yeah, that's very two responses to the truth of that. I to say, first of all, that the grace of God, the Holy Spirit, always works through the community, your fellow human beings. That's how we experience the love of God, our dependence upon others. And the second, to reaffirm what you said about our culture, we glorify independence. And therefore, elderly people refuse to acknowledge their interdependence. If I could just tell one story. One of my colleagues at St. Olaf tells about his parents down in Texas who lived within 10 miles over there of his sister and their daughter. And they almost died of starvation. They were seriously sick in their own little home, because they didn't want to bother the daughter to come and get them. They couldn't come out to get groceries, and the neighbor found them in desperate need. You know, this ideal that we are so independent, we will not recognize that we need the help of one another. That's what our society does to us. And the biblical sense is that we are interdependent. My friend Gordy Rasmussen, the good old farmer in our religion department at St. Olaf, says it's the difference in, you know, understanding human nature as sort of a barbed wire fence of some of your farmers. And you know how each spike sticks up by itself. That's the society we are. But we really are created by God in community, like the chicken wire fence, interwoven with one another in the web of life. And we need to acknowledge that. And not humiliate people, feel that we're humiliated when we recognize our dependence on others.
How does that, though, fit with this other concept that you mentioned, that you have to continue to recognize each person's autonomy and their decision-making powers, even though they may be quite ill or maybe not quite able to make decisions?
Yeah. Well, that's some of you have had experience of that, haven't you? You know, when with elderly persons do you move in and make decisions? That's not easy. You recognize that you must do it at certain points. But my point, when I worked in nursing homes where they drug them up and make zombies out of them and take every decision away from them, just makes me furious. The refusal to recognize their autonomy, and so you have to see to do not take any more autonomy away from them than absolutely essential for their own safety, for their own good, not for your good, but if it's necessary for their own good, you take it away. Yes.
Sometimes when you have to move in mm-hmm. on them like that, possibly you could give them other lesser choices to make so that they still have something left to choose.
Our time is up and you feel free to leave, but I would like to, you know, just mention one story about this, my work in the nursing home. They had, every time a crisis came or a move came for a patient in the nursing home, they had a staff conference at Ebenezer, and I was just so impressed that all the 8, 9, 10 professionals that were dealing with that person came together. What should be the strategy for more freedom for this individual? And they were dealing with the person who the lady who refused to eat. She really just wanted to die. And the pharmacist and the doctor there said, well, if it's a case of depression this is due to some imbalance in drugs and so forth, we'll work on that first. But the nurse and the care worker there said, if it's her free decision, we're going to respect her free decision not to eat and not force her to eat. Does our freedom include the freedom to set the limit to our own life? That's really something that I'm very concerned about. The Van Dusens, the president of Union Seminary, he and his wife committed suicide as an act of their own free choice because they felt they were at that stage of life where they couldn't be. Is that part of our freedom? I think it is. But whether it should be done or not, but you know, that's what it means to be these free people. Well, there's so many. Maybe we can talk about some of these things tomorrow. I'm not going to babble on so long tomorrow. And give us some time to raise some of these issues. We're going to talk about a deeper wisdom, this possibility for mental growth and that comes with aging in our session tomorrow. But I think maybe if some of you want to get that first setting, you better move in a hurry. Thank you. There. There you go.